Sidebar Episode 128, James Remar, brought to you by Graham Crackers Comics.
Welcome to Sidebar, four color conversations on comics, art, and pop culture, featuring creator interviews and roundtable discussions.
All right, let's talk about James Remar.
Yes, James Remar.
We just recorded an episode with James Remar not too long ago.
He was awesome.
He was awesome.
Definitely.
We say awesome all the time, don't we?
Yeah. But it's true. I mean, it fits so well. It is.
It does, yeah. Well, let's introduce ourselves before we continue on.
I'm Dwayne.
This is Adrian.
And I'm Swain, and we just recorded an episode of the show with character actor James Remar.
The Remarkable. James Remar.
Yeah, there you go.
Little alliteration play on words there.
Very little.
Go ahead. It's getting late.
Exactly. It is.
Anyway, Remar is a friend of a friend. We were actually put in contact with Remar by our buddy Warren Drummond, storyboard artist, started in California. And for those who don't know who James Remar is.
Yeah. James Remar was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He now makes his home in California. Started acting in his 20s. His first feature film was On the Yard. Other films that he's been in include Cruising, The Warriors.
Warriors!
Band of the Hand, The Cotton Club, 48 Hours.
Gans!
The Renaissance Man, Judge Dredd.
Dredd.
I am the law!
What Lies Beneath, Pineapple Express. His TV work includes Flash Forward, Numbers, Sex and the City, and of course, currently he's been seen on Showtime's Dexter. He just finished working on Red in New Orleans, based on the Wildstorm comic by Warren Ellis and Cully Hamner. It's being produced now as a major motion picture starring James, Bruce Willis, Morgan Freeman, and Mary Louise Parker.
And John Malkovich, Brian Cox.
And I think Helen Mirren's in it?
I think so, yeah. There's quite a few cool people in this movie, so this one could be pretty good.
Yeah, you know. Red is due out in October this year.
All right. Definitely look
And Remar is really honest, and he talks about his life, about some of his ups and downs. Yeah. He talks about how the business has changed.
He's
talks
an
about
actor's how much actor.
He,
yeah. Yes.
Yeah, how much he loves the craft. Even today, you know, he talks about how he loves the craft.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, his candor was definitely refreshing.
For sure. But before we get to James.
All right, just want to let you guys know that this episode has been brought to you by Graham Crackers Comics. Look for these guys online at grahamcrackers.com. Now, they have 9 dinky little stores in their home state of Illinois, 3 in the Chicago area. They have an okay subscription service, which offers a pull and hold, and a few other geeky goodies, too. But again, their online store can always be found at grahamcrackers.com.
That's it. What's up,
Show
John?
Show off.
So let's get to James Remar.
Let's do it.
The Remarkable.
Well, for those who don't know, some of the stuff you've done, and we're going to put special emphasis, James, on the geek relevant stuff, but the Incredible Hulk TV show goes way back to the beginning.
Yes. You know, that has no business being on there because I was never on it.
You? Really? Oh, really?
I have no idea how ever that ever got on the on the IMDb. I kind of leave it there for amusement's pay. I never did the Incredible Hulk.
Okay, wow. I'm floored. Okay. Wow. I thought IMDb was pretty rock solid.
There's a couple in there that are wrong.
Okay. Now I'm scared.
No, you can keep going.
We have the Warriors, of course. We know that.
Yeah, what comes after the Incredible Hulk?
It's Incredible Hulk, and then it goes to, let's see, On the Yard.
Yes, that's correct. That was my first feature film.
Okay. On the Yard. Okay. And that was 1979.
Yeah, and I didn't do any television prior to that.
Okay. Okay.
You know, and On the Yard is not 1979. On the Yard is 1977.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, because that was with Christopher Christopherson and...
No, it was with Thomas G. Waits, Mike Kellen, John Hurd, a whole cast of Dominic Chianese was in it. It was a very small, independent kind of movie that was shot entirely within the walls of an active prison. It was the first and only one of its kind.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. All right. Well, we apologize for showing our ignorance here.
Yeah. No, that's cool, but...
So you're the same as all these other fuckers.
Wow.
Moving on, Cruising,
Yes. Hill yes, Street. I'm in Cruising.
Yeah, Hill Street Blues.
Yes, yes.
48 Hours is Gans.
Yes.
Cotton Club, you played Dutch Schultz, Miami Vice.
You missed Long Riders in there.
Oh, you were in Long Riders? I love that movie, man.
And Windwalker, and that's the chronology.
Okay.
Miami Vice, and actually Don Johnson lives in my neighborhood, and we see each other from time to time.
Cool. Oh, cool. Okay, we were just talking about Don Johnson and Miami Vice before we turned the recorder on.
I like Don. He's a good guy.
Yeah. Band of the Hand.
Yes.
Nestor Quintana, sir. You are the man, sir.
Drugstore Cowboy.
That was a good memory.
Judge Dredd, The X-Files.
I got to throw in Quiet Cool. That was my first movie for you, James.
Oh, yeah. How about that? We shot that up in Santa Cruz, man. That was New Line Cinema's first feature film.
That was their very first?
And Bob Shea is actually in it.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
and if I'd only been less fucked up at the time.
Let's see. Judge Dredd.
Mm-hmm. Uncredited performance.
You weren't credited in Judge Dredd?
Yeah, I didn't take a credit because it's such a tiny little part.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't do that anymore.
Okay. Right. Every bit counts.
Not advised, right? Yeah.
Twilight Zone, Too Fast, Too Furious, Sex in the City, of course, Battlestar Galactica.
Yes.
Justice League, you played Hawkman, Qatar Hall.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Batman, Brave and the Bold, Ratatouille.
All voiceover stuff.
Yes, all voiceover stuff. Mm-hmm. Pineapple Express. You played the military guy with the eye patch, right?
Uh-huh.
And Numbers, Flash Forward, Ben 10.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you played a role on the Showtime series Dexter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I played Dexter's dad.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You played Harry Morgan. And you were just in New Orleans recently working on the comic book-based Red.
Red.
Yes.
Yes, sir. Sir, you are diverse, and
there's a shitload of other stuff in there.
Yes. I mean, I just jumped around, just tried to pick up some stuff that that we kind of knew and that we thought that other folks would know. But I mean, you've got 4 or 5 pages of IMDb there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got about I've been around a long time.
Yeah.
And I was a stage trained. I am a stage trained actor. I did all the off Broadway stuff and off Broadway, and I was even doing Broadway when Cruising was released. Mm-hmm. We did that. I did Broadway in 1979, 1980. I did The Warriors, and we filmed that in 1978. It was released in 1979. Mm-hmm. But I was an acting student from 1975 to like 1977. I started getting some parts. I studied with Sandy Meisner and Stella Adler in New York City, and that's to answer your question initially that you asked. That's what I was doing before I, got into the movie business.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I got my training. I got my, I learned the words.
Now, James, you mentioned theater as part of your repertoire when you were honing your craft. How important do you think that is as far as the formative years of an actor? Because you don't see a lot of that nowadays.
Well, for me, it's... For me, it was vital. I think the whole industry has suffered in general. And I don't want to be like one of those guys that like was in the silent movies and said the talkies have destroyed the business. I'm well aware of that, but it's. I just don't feel you can get a real acting experience unless you've been on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's essential. I think that I feel like a film actor is is someone who doesn't really you have to do it all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think it's very important to have at least done it all a little bit. I don't know how else to do it, and I just feel that the way that the world has changed, the business has changed so much that it's very, very difficult now for any young actor to have the kind of experience that I have, where it was you could work some shitty little job in New York City, and you could make your rent, and you could take your acting classes, and you could go to auditions, and when you got a part, you could blow the job off and get another one.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go and you could see great actors. I saw Julie Harris and Ben Gazzara and Colleen Dewhurst and Al Pacino, all for like $7.
Yeah.
you know, doing plays in New York City. You know, like plays. You know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Belle of Amherst, The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel. That's what I saw. All those big, big stars. They were movie stars, you know, still doing their thing on the New York stage, you know, in between movies. And, you know, you could see them for a reasonable price. And then the whole thing just shut down. Film production basically ended in the city of New York. It all moved up to Canada.
Yes.
They shot a couple of television shows. Some, you know, the TV and film moved out to California, but then that all migrated up to Vancouver. And the theater world just died. They put a stake through its heart.
Wow.
And you know, plays in New York City are rare. They're a thing of the past, particularly a decent one.
Right.
I mean, you know, revivals of Streetcar Named Desire with, you know, Alec Baldwin or, you know, and God bless him. I shouldn't say that because I think he's a fantastic guy.
Yeah.
Or anything. It's like you have to do stuff like that instead of new original material. It's very, very rare, and it's hard to come by. And boy, if you're not on series television and you're not... you're not a regular on a TV show or one of a handful of people, you really, it's almost impossible to live as an actor. And I've observed it, and I've seen a lot of, you know, distance from what really brought the American theater to life and the American film. And that's why I think that the American film and American film, world has suffered so much and has become so virtual, so to speak.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a long-winded answer to a short question, but
no.
So, you know, it actually wasn't. You know, how formative is it? I think it's essential. I mean, you know, Faye Dunaway. You know, she's a great actress. George right. Scott, great actor.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, Richard Harris.
You know, even Tom Cruise went to the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
You know. All these guys were stage people.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta do it, and I think it just kills the. I just think it kills the craft, and I think it kills the whole thing, because nobody gets hungry, nobody has a chance to like really fuck up on stage, and you know, and you know, furthermore, you know, the whole business migrating to Canada just killed us. So there.
Okay, that works. Exhale. That's excellent. What play was it for you that made you feel like, okay, I want to do this for a living now as my craft?
Oh, I know. By the time I got to doing theater in New York, I'd already made my decision.
Okay.
You know, thought that I wanted to be I liked effects and blood and that kind of thing when I was a kid, and I did monster makeup and you know. I became peripherally involved, like a summer camp. I went. They put on some plays, and they gave me a part. And it actually started to really move me. And I remembered that when I was a little kid, watching the movies, I was like all by myself in the movie theater, and I watched Spartacus, and it brought tears to my eyes. And it was a very powerful, emotional, private experience. You know, in the movies, and I had a similar experience watching West Side Story, and I was somebody that needed to have that kind of emotional release. And it found its way eventually to ask, why not acting? I'd been a laborer, and I had come from a really well-educated family. You know, my doctors and lawyers and master's degrees, you know, left and right, and you know, I dropped out of high school, and it just it wasn't for lack of brains. It just wasn't the way that that I saw myself going. It was I needed to have an emotional experience, and I wasn't getting that in school, and I found that the emotional experience that I started to create became a negative one. I needed a place where I could act out drama. And so, you know, I was pounding nails and I was moving concrete and all that other stuff. And, you know, I found the theaters. I found the, you know, I actually went to Florida when I was laid off of my roofing job. And I tried out, just for the hell of it, for this outdoor historical drama called Cross and Sword about the founding of St. Augustine.
Okay.
And I got a job for $50 a week. And, you know, we gave like, I don't know, 8 or 9 performances a week, and they paid me $50. It was like $5 a performance.
You're lucky.
Yeah, but I was, you know, and it was non-union, and I was terrible, but I had this great summer in Florida, and, you know, and I thought, where do I go from here if I wanted to do this? And I met the old actor Richard Boone, who had a home in St. Augustine, and he came and he put his name on our little program as a, as, and he came and visited the last night, and, you know, he got drunk with us, and, you know, and I said, so what does an actor do next? And he says, the Neighborhood Playhouse. And I went to the Neighborhood Playhouse, and they gave me an interview based on the strength of a letter from his wife, because the guy got sick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they let me in the next day.
Mm.
You know, so I made my decision in the middle of coming. I came back from Florida. I was laboring again. I said, you know, I'm going to be a doctor or a jet pilot. And, you know, the military, I didn't, you know, it was just, it was out of the question for me.
Mm-hmm.
And although my brother, interestingly, he joined and you know, the military paid for his medical education.
Ah, okay.
My brother's a surgeon, and he joined the Army to get his medical degrees.
Okay, smart guy.
And I'm really proud of him. I'm going to do it, and I just didn't feel like I could thrive in the academic world. Mm. You know, now that's more what I'm inclined towards.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm making a really that's the story, man.
Okay.
And I just decided, you know, acting, I can get a little bit of experience, I can travel the world, and I think I can see a little bit of everything. And I realized that, you know, I looked at the credits, I watched a movie, and I saw that there were credits. You know, I said, what's a gaffer? What's a key grip? What's a best boy?
Yeah.
You know, and I said, you know, and it said casting by. And I said, fuck, there's people that make these things.
Right.
You know, Kirk Douglas isn't really Spartacus.
He really isn't.
He acted his ass off in it, though. So
yeah.
He was a dynamic guy. Spartacus was a great character, and he had One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on Broadway and Spartacus on the other side of the street opening at the same time.
Wow.
Okay. And he was very, very conscious guy. You know, Spartacus was a guy that freed the slaves. He had a very, very big social commitment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, there's a guy that's like, you know, there's these crazy people, and they make more sense than the sane ones.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that guy. I think he was just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And he really stood out in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk Douglas would have been was an amazing Randall Patrick McMurphy. He was the first one, man. And it wasn't until his son Michael took over the production of Cuckoo's Nest that it was actually made into a film.
I didn't realize that.
Wow. That Michael Douglas is the executive producer on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And by the time that happened, Kirk was too old to play McMurphy.
Okay.
And so Jack Nicholson got the role of a lifetime.
Yes,
he did.
Yes.
Set him on his way.
Yeah, definitely. James, you talk about like working shitty jobs and kind of, you know, doing theater and honing your craft and all of that. As far as being a working actor today goes, I mean, do you enjoy the consistency of a fairly regular gig like, you know, like the one you have on Dexter? Or does jumping around and staying challenged by doing new roles, does that keep you fresh and keep you on your toes? Do you still enjoy, you know, the newness?
When it happens.
Okay.
You know, it's I'm 56 years old. So a gig is nice.
Mm-hmm.
I've been an actor for over 30 years, and I've played everything from a caveman to an American Indian to a billionaire playboy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to stretch as far as they'll let me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a guy that was who became a self-determining person. I did not create my own equity and create my own parts. I'm, you know, someone that auditions and tries to get jobs.
Mm.
So, you know, that's not my favorite part. Mm. You know, but I love, I love doing acting jobs. You know, I did a scene with Malkovich and Bruce Willis and Mary Louise Parker, and man, it just was, I just, fuck, I wish I'd been there for 6 months. You know, creating it and turning it out and churning it and find the behaviors. Because I find behaviors, man, in the tiniest parts.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've been called upon to find something that I got to make this thing alive.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see What Lies Beneath by any chance?
Yes.
Do you remember it?
I do remember it.
Wasn't that with Michelle Pfeiffer?
Yeah, yeah. Harrison Ford. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Michelle Pfeiffer thinks I killed my wife in the beginning.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then she sees me at a cocktail party. She realizes that she's alive and fine. And Miranda Otto played my wife. And I made this gesture where I kind of grabbed her throat and made a face like I was strangling her.
Mm-hmm.
When Michelle Pfeiffer comes around through the party, then kind of a blow it off ha 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 gesture,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it really took the air out of her. But it was a crescendo in the movie,
mm-hmm. Right?
Because the movie got tension, 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 and then it all went for a second. So then the tension had a chance to rebuild, and it was a spontaneous, it was an extemporaneous gesture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't written in it. It was a moment.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And man, it just sewed it right up. It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
James, is that what actors mean when they talk about trusting their instincts?
Well, yeah. Okay. That's part of it.
Okay.
You know, finding behaviors. And then the people that you work for have to trust your instincts,
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time now, because movies are such a corporate experience that they really are, you know, it's all about the bottom line. The $6 million film is a very hard film to make.
Yeah.
You know, the October Skies are impossible to make. Mm. These very, you know, the small films for a few million bucks. These are just like shit. They're like almost a thing of the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's either the $75-80 million blockbuster or you know, the $1 million low budget in New York,
mm-hmm. yeah.
that, you know, is never going to see the light of day.
Mm.
Occasionally. I mean, there's very little in between. And when you do a one of those huge, huge, huge movies, and there's a bunch of executives, and they're not really giving you know, the person in charge, his head, one of the sentences that you'll hear, you know, when an actor wants to do something, they'll say, "We're afraid that," you know, dot, dot, dot.
Mm-hmm.
The audience won't get it.
Mm.
And whenever you make a fear-based decision, you have a fearful result.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I've heard them say, "Well, we're afraid that." And, yeah, they're afraid. They're afraid that the audience isn't going to get it. And so the movies get dumber and dumber and dumber.
Yep. Yeah.
The plethora of horror flicks and splatter flicks with major stars in them is everywhere, because not even Martin Scorsese can get a film made.
Mm.
You know, Shutter Island or something, it's a splatter flick.
Yeah.
Is it really? I hadn't heard that about that film.
Yeah,
isn't that just a lot of people going, you know, with a lot of gibberish and going nuts and chopping each other up?
Yeah, pretty
yes.
much.
Yep.
Yeah. That sums it up.
Mm-hmm. You know, like the door slams and you just...
that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You're trapped here forever.
Okay.
And to your point, I mean, look at... I mean, they're making... Friday the 13th. This came out today, didn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
So what came out today?
Friday the 13th.
A new version of Friday the
13th.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, in my lifetime, the fucking Nightmare on Elm Street. Friday the 13th came out a few months ago.
Right.
You know, so now they're going to recycle that hunk of shit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like, come on.
Yeah.
And it's because they just, you know, it's because it's like, why the fuck don't we make a Slumdog Millionaire here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you saw that film.
No, and it was excellent.
Yeah.
Did you see Slumdog Millionaire?
We saw Slumdog Millionaire, and I couldn't believe that they made a movie about who wants to be a millionaire entertaining, but they did.
Right.
Because it wasn't about that, you know.
Right.
Well, it was about that. It was and we're a white audience watching Muslims in India.
Mm-hmm.
And it had real important depth to us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, I love Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the funny thing about Avatar is that you had to have $200 million worth of effects for people to sit in the seat and watch a very, very simple cowboys and Indians love story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a very simple script.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it had integrity pretty much. You know, it was, but to get people to sit in the seat for that story, you had to spend $200 million.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, I just think that's where we've gotten away from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, I think that has hurt actors a lot.
Mm-hmm. James, what do you think about the film Hurt Locker?
You know, I have to be honest, I didn't see it.
Okay.
But I heard it was very good.
See, I haven't seen it either, but I know it swept, not swept, but it was one of the favorites at the Oscars.
Yeah, it virtually swept is what it did.
Yeah, and it was...
Yeah, it did virtually sweep it.
And it was,
so don't tell me I didn't, you can't say I didn't see it, because then I'll get in trouble.
Yeah. But it was a smaller film, though, for the most part. I mean, even though it was, I don't know if it was actually shot on location in the Middle East, but I mean, it was a smaller film for the most part. And it still got a lot of recognition. Now, it didn't pay off at the box office, obviously, in the way that Avatar did.
No, well, there's the conundrum. It's like, you know, Godfather was actually a smaller film.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the paradox. It's like, you know, Hurt Locker had you know, it needs more of a broad appeal. It needs, you know, people need to sit in the seat and watch it. So I don't know what it. I don't know what the deal is. I mean, maybe people just don't want to see that shit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they just want to see big boom bang pow sock.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's life imitating art or the other way around.
Escapism. And speaking of escapism, when you played in Battlestar Galactica for two episodes as Mir. How did you come about that role? Did you just audition for it like you regularly do?
No, they offered it to me. I get offered some stuff.
Okay.
You know, I was angling because I wanted to be those things they were fighting.
Oh, Cylon?
A Cylon. Okay. Yeah, I was saying shit, and I was really angling to be a Cylon so I could come back.
You would have been awesome as one of the final nine, one of the final five.
They wouldn't bite.
Ah, they suck.
You know, it was a minor part. They got me up there, and all right, what the fuck?
But you drilled it down. You did a good job on it. I was convinced. See, when I see you in different roles, I never see you as the person that you were in a previous role.
Right.
Like you could play Gans, and I didn't see you as Gans when you were in Battlestar Galactica.
I didn't even realize when you played Richard Wright on Sex in the City. I didn't even know that was Gans.
Yeah, exactly.
And
I am of the Lon Chaney school of acting.
Okay.
You know, that was my inspiration when I was a kid. That's what I wanted to do. I believe that the best actors are character actors.
Yeah.
But you know, in my own not so humble, heartfelt opinion, I'm a leading man, and I can play any of those parts.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's I get a little too big on screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like I can play any of those parts.
Absolutely.
You know, and you know, it's but they're hard to come by.
Yeah.
It's hard to come by.
An example of your talent to me from the very beginning, I got to be honest with you, my first, me recognizing you as an actor was in Warriors, as Ajax. And you didn't get anywhere near the screen time you should have gotten to me. You didn't last long enough throughout the entire experience, as far as I was concerned. And they tied you up, and you went to jail, I guess is what happened. But to me, I mean, it would have been a much better film if you had been throughout the rest of it, because the guy that was a lead warrior, he was a punk man by comparison. I mean, just not that he's a bad actor, just in terms of the spirit of the person was just different.
Right.
I was pretty fierce.
Yeah, you were.
Man, I was on fire to act. I got to tell you something. I was on fire to, Ajax was written for a 7-foot-tall, 300-pound guy. He was supposed to be enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they auditioned a lot of big guys. And, you know, I just... they actually were going to audition me for Swan, you know, for the Michael Beck part.
Okay.
But, you know, my teeth were kind of fucked up back then.
Okay.
But, so they auditioned me for Ajax, and, you know, I gave a big audition, and they gave me the part.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just had to, you know, pump myself up to the size of it. You know, that's just what I had to do. It was a part that I really had to get really fierce about.
Yeah.
You know, and really, 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 really big. I'm kind of a romantic and a lover and that kind of silly stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a few. My timing's been pretty shitty. But you know, when people saw me in the I've been very, very blessed because I developed a terrible drug problem, and I got through it, and you know I've been and I developed it before it was fashionable,
Okay. Was it ever fashionable?
You know, I think that there's been a chic about it, and you know, there's been certain actors that have had people that watch them and babysit them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't have any of that stuff.
Insert Tom Sizemore here.
You know, I ain't inserting any names at all.
Yeah.
But I just know that it's you know, people have been you know, been minded and babysat, and you know, and I just don't feel like the size of their talent merited it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that anybody does, and I think it hurts them.
Yeah.
But you know, I really shit the bed. I really took a great you know, career and personal life and messed it up. You know, with a terrible drug habit.
Yeah.
But you know, I've got almost 23 years of sobriety now, and I'm just lucky to be anywhere.
Mm, yeah, well, congratulations.
Definitely.
Well, thank you. You know, it's, yeah. But I got to be an adult. You know, it boy, I'm telling you, man, it's been an interesting ride.
Mm-hmm.
I love being an actor. I got to tell you, I love acting. I when I get a good script and it starts to talk to me and I have a chance to play it, it really blows my skirt up. and they're few and far between. You know, it's like, oh, this guy, you know, this guy's playing, or that guy's playing, or this guy's playing, or this guy's playing it, you know, and it's like, and they're few and far between. Mm-hmm. To really be able to get your teeth on the scenery and chew it up is
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a great opportunity, and they're hard to come by. And so I just pretty much do everything.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. You know, people ask me, what choices have you made? You know, if it's not some kind of disgusting part, you know, I pretty much do it all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, very well.
Exactly.
Well, you're very, very kind. I appreciate it. And you know, I love being an actor, being able to talk about acting.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, talking shop is very exciting to me.
Mm.
You know, it's and we're talking about something that's the kind of experience that you know, actors are watched because people get to watch themselves.
Yeah.
You know, the really good actors, I think, are the actors where people feel identify with them.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. insert self here.
mm-hmm. There we go.
Now, I had a question for you.
Please.
I had read something somewhere, James, that initially in James Cameron's Alien sequel, that you were initially cast as Colonel Hicks.
No. The Aliens was the sequel to Alien.
Right,
right.
And I was initially cast as Corporal Hicks.
Corporal Hicks, there we go.
And that, I was fired after a couple of weeks of filming because I got busted for possession of drugs.
Oh, wow, okay.
And Michael Biehn replaced me.
Okay.
All right, okay.
I was, I had a bit of a row with the director of Uncommon Valor, and I had spent too many days partying, and I was fired and replaced by Patrick Swayze.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody wanted to hire me.
Yeah.
And as soon as I got fired from Band of the Hand, I mean, Aliens, you know, I landed back in the United States, and they gave me a job in Band of the Hand.
Yeah, which was excellent, you know, sir.
So I didn't, you know, I wasn't paying attention.
Hmm.
You know?
Okay.
I wasn't paying attention to my problem with all those fucking people. And, you know, I got to talk with Cameron a couple of times over the years, and, I really love the guy, you know. I don't know if I'll ever get to work with him again, but, you know, he said I would.
Yeah.
And, you know, he expressed, you know, that, and he says he knows that I've been sober all this time. And, you know, I like what the guy does. I like him. I thought we had it was an honor to be able to get started. I just wasn't focused, and I fucked it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of directors, let me ask you about another one, also tangentially related to Aliens, the whole Alien franchise, in fact. Walter Hill.
Yes.
He directed you in both 48 Hours and The Warriors.
Walter Hill put me on the map, man.
Absolutely.
Walter Hill directed me in 48 Hours, The Warriors, and The Long Riders.
Right.
And Walter Hill is the guy that said, this kid's got some talent. He recognized me, and he put me on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And getting fired from Aliens alienated me from him for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Walter didn't hire me again for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I know why, because I made him look bad.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it was fucked up, and it was like, you know, I was sober. Let me see, almost 10 years. I was sober 8 years, and mm-hmm. he put me in Wild Bill.
Mm. Oh, he did do that.
Yeah. And it was such a treat, man, to be able to work for him again.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like coming home. Mm. And then, you know, he wanted to put me in Last Man Standing.
Mm-hmm.
With opposite Willis, but the studio wanted Walken.
Mm-hmm.
So that was cool, but it was an honor, and you know, I love Walter, and the last time I saw him was at David Carradine's funeral.
Oh, okay.
You know, and Carradine was a friend, and you know, he was the first big movie star that I worked opposite.
Mm.
You know, we did that scene with a knife fight in Long Riders, and
mm-hmm.
you know, Carradine was a movie star at the time, you know. He'd just mm-hmm. done Bound for Glory and,
yep.
you know, Long Riders. He was the height of his powers. And, you know, sadly we had to, you know, bury him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
James, let me ask you something. You talk a lot about, you know, your relationships with various people and the situations. You ended up on the shitty end of the stick, obviously, because of your drug problem and it affecting your career. How important is relationships within the world that you're in? In other words, you talk about having to audition. You know, obviously people are trying to judge your talent and trying to see if you're the type for the role, but also how important is it to, you know, to have good relationships and to have a good reputation like what you're describing here now?
Well, you know, I do have a good reputation.
Mm-hmm.
But largely because of my versatility, sometimes people don't know where to put me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I can fit in any place they want me to,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, it's like people get surprised. It's like they put me in a suit and I play opposite Kim Cattrall in Sex and the City and people are like, whoa,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
And that's like being surprised that like Michael Jordan can swim, you know?
It's a very good analogy. And you're also in. You did a brief stint. Well, actually, one show for the unit, man. And you played out. You played a judge, advocate, general type of detective guy.
I was an interrogator guy.
Yeah, it was awesome, man. You rocked that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know. I thought I don't know why I'm not a regular and getting paid millions of dollars on these shows. But relationships are. You know, if you've got a Ridley Scott and you're Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know that's. You know, that's a De Niro, Scorsese, Caprio, mm-hmm. Scorsese kind of relationship, mm-hmm. and I have my Walter Hill,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, but I fucked it up
mm-hmm.
for, you know, for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know Walter still cares for me, and I know he respects me, mm-hmm. and, you know, maybe, you know, I just don't think he's done much lately.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. But he was the bomb back in the 80s. He ruled the school.
Yeah,
he ruled the school, and he was my mentor and he was the guy that you know brought me into the fold.
Mm-hmm.
More so than anyone else, and I'll always be grateful to him for that. I love Walter, and relationships. Yeah, I mean, if you happen to be, but there's only a handful of people that, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, because the business is so tight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want to be around people they want to be around.
Mm.
It's tight. It's gotten to be like it was. Shit, I guess in the old studio days.
James, let me ask you something about. You mentioned earlier about working opposite Bruce Willis and a few other people. I guess working on Red in New Orleans. And you were talking about, you know, you described it. We almost could kind of feel the electricity that you were trying to communicate to us. How often in your profession, for any actor, does working with great directors or a strong director or other great actors like elevate your performance or affect it? Or do you just try to step up and do your thing mm-hmm. at times? How often does the collaboration really like lift you and what you're bringing to the table?
Every time.
Mm-hmm.
Every time. You know, if you're. You know, it's just like being in sync with someone. There's times that it. I mean, you know, working with top shelf talent is going to make you better.
Mm-hmm.
It has to. Because everything about the piece is going to be better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you work with folks that aren't quite as talented, or maybe just aren't quite as caring, or they're not just you know, it can, you know, it can make things a little more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that most directors are really quite good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they know the craft and they know how to, you know, point the camera and they know a little bit about dramatic structure, most of them are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I've been with a few that aren't very good, but, you know, when I did my few scenes with Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer in a Bob Zemeckis film, I think it just, you know, it was walking on an entirely different level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, working with Schwenke and Malkovich and Willis and Mary Louise Parker, you know, it's playing with the big boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you're running down the court in the NBA and they fire you a pass, you got to be able to catch it in your hands, or it's gonna you're either gonna miss it or it's gonna go through your hands and bash you in the face.
Right, right.
You know, so hopefully I kept up with them.
Right.
You know, and there's other times when, you know, you work with people that aren't as good, and, you know, you just got to be patient and work harder.
Mm-hmm.
So in this latest movie, Red, that you're playing and you're starring in, is there any active parts in there that you're like rolling with punches and shooting? Obviously, it's an action oriented comedy of some sort, and you're going to be doing some.
I have a very small part.
Do you? Okay.
Yes. A very, very, very small part.
Okay.
It's really nice. You know, anytime you get to speak in one of these movies, it's really nice, and it's sort of like, yeah, hey, we can have Remar in that. And they didn't make me audition for it. They just offered it to me.
Mm. Good.
But yeah. It's, you know, it's a part where, you know, this guy, you know, Willis is an old operative, and, you know, I'm a contemporary of his. I operated on a similar, you know, old CIA guys.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
And, you know, I'm one of the guys on the list, and he's like, hey, what are you doing? And I'm like, you know, I can, we have a little confrontation, and then we start talking about things, and then, you know, I'm gone.
Okay. Okay. So you don't sign up for the adventure, basically, in this movie?
Unfortunately not. It looks as if, for a moment, I'm going to be the fourth musketeer.
Uh-huh.
But unfortunately, it doesn't pan out that way.
Okay.
Understandable. Okay. Understandable.
No, it sucks.
It does.
You know, just being Ajax handcuffed to the fucking bench one more time.
Right. I have a segue for you later on that we're going to go into briefly. I don't know if it's the time or place to do it right now, but I kind of came up with there's a strange reoccurrence in the careers where you've always been kind of betrayed by women. At least three times I can count. I was playing with Swain and talking to him about it earlier, and we called it, you know, once, twice, three times betrayed by a lady.
Okay, well, what are they?
Okay, well, the first time it was as Ajax. You were portrayed by the female cop. She, you know, she acted like she was going to solicit, and, you know, you were soliciting a prostitute and going to get some, and she...
Well, I don't know that she betrayed me, but she certainly fooled me.
Yeah, okay, okay. The second time that I can recall was as Gans, when your ex-girlfriend told, you know, the cops where to find you.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, this is bear with me, James. This is loose, okay?
Yeah.
And the third time...
I think they were on to me anyway, but go ahead.
Right, well, yeah, they were. And the third time was as Mir, you were shot by Sharon Agathon in the Battlestar Galactica series.
Did Grace Park shoot me?
Yeah, she did.
God damn it, I thought she was so cute.
Yeah, so that was, I thought that was kind of interesting. I'm sure there's been many more times where it hasn't been that way, but it's just a...
Stood out to you.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting.
Oh, I think women have done me in a bunch of times. I think I've had my comeuppance from lots of girls in movies.
Yeah, I'm sure. James, we talked about some of the voice acting you did earlier when I was reading your resume, and as far as that goes, I was curious how you got involved with that, and being obviously a great live actor in front of the camera and on stage and so forth, was it tough for you to kind of push through and break that fourth wall, if you will, with just your voice, or did that come naturally to you?
You know, I think I'm a better, you know, on-camera actor than I am a voice actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just kept trying and trying and trying. I started auditioning for commercials, and you know, I can do some silly voices. And but I started auditioning for commercials with the voiceover people, and I finally got one. It is kind of a numbers game, and I've had a few campaigns over the years, and I had one really big one for a year. I was the voice of Lexus.
Yeah, Lexus. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah,
for 1 year, and then they, you know, went with someone else.
Yeah,
and you know, I guess that happened. But that was a big money thing. You know, shit. that was like the most money I ever made.
Wow. Oh, was it?
I had no idea. Yeah, working doing the commercial voiceover stuff for a car is you make a fortune.
And could you?
But I spent it all already.
James, could you literally like show up in your pajamas and do the work?
You could, but I prefer not to.
Okay.
Because even when I'm doing that sort of thing, I like to have some element of costume, just because it makes me feel like I'm.
There you go.
I'm really there.
In the moment, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, it just makes me feel like I'm really there. If I dress like a slob, I sort of tend to talk like a slob.
Okay.
It just made it better for me. But yeah, I had one big shot with commercial voiceover stuff. But I did Shell Visa MasterCard. I mean Shell MasterCard. I did Owens Corning building where I did Degree deodorant. I did GMC trucks for a few of those. I you know, a bunch of junk here and there.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Well, man, hey, it's work,
you know.
All right.
Well, you know it is, and you know, Jeff Bridges does Duracell and Honda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like you and Donald Sutherland and Morgan Freeman, you know.
Right. Well, those guys get paid $1 million.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And now Kiefer Sutherland, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they don't make them audition either.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I audition for everything. If they want Morgan Freeman, they beg him to come in and do
right.
it.
Right. Mm-hmm. This is true.
Yeah. And then he does what he does, and then he leaves.
Yeah. He gives magic advice.
You know, me, they push around.
Oh, well.
Shame
well,
on them.
Give us this one. Can you give us this one again? Can you give us this one again? Can you give us this one? You know, one time this guy was just like, you know, it's like, you know what, guys? You know, you don't fucking get what you want. I got to step outside.
Okay.
I was ready to quit because they were so. Had I been anybody else, they would have just said, "That's great."
Yep.
Because okay. You know, they get 600 different versions. They don't know what they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for you know, so it's not the most fun work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it goes. That sounds like it goes back to what you said before about fears. Like you said, they don't really know what they want. They want mm-hmm. to make. They don't want to make a decision and stand by it. And you hear that happening oftentimes. So,
mm-hmm. Well, they don't know what they want. They don't know what they want until they hear it, yeah. and then they're still wrong. Okay. And a lot of times, you know, commercial stuff is tough. You know, if you got a nice smooth voice and. With a certain degree of security, like a Jeff Bridges, they're just not going to dispute what Jeff says.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd be crazy to.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I don't want to say that I'm as good as Jeff. Mm-hmm. You know, he's an Academy Award winning, you know, actor, and he's got a really appealing sound, and he's really really good. You know, he's got such a smooth, natural, wonderful tone, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you got to understand, I'm not complaining.
No, of course not. No.
You know, you don't. You know, there are tiers of actors. You know, there's enlisted men and there's officers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have a feeling I may actually be able to really. I got my fingers crossed. You know that I maybe get the kind of recognition that say somebody like Jack Palance got later in his career. He's always been a hero of mine.
Yeah, Jack Palance.
Absolutely. Right.
You know, great, great actor. I mean, you know, much greater actor than me. But there's a certain stamina to it, and you know, I have a family to support and protect, and yeah. You know, they're important to me. And I think that these things, you know, I believe in the synchronicity in the universe. And if I weren't meant to be doing this, I don't think I would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for some reason, I just don't feel that it would be happening at all. Maybe I'm not, you know, when I talk about it and I start to tell you how much I love it, mm-hmm. I realize that I'm not psychologically finished with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I'm fed up with having to work so hard sometimes to get jobs.
Right.
You know, but I think that's, you know, pretty common and typical of the middle-aged man who's you know, looking at, hasn't even gotten his fucking gold watch. You know, that maybe I was very, very good as, you know, the next guy or,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I'm not trying to single myself out, but it's being finished with it psychologically from the actual performing standpoint, I don't feel that I am.
Okay. Okay.
Jimmy Cagney said it's very important when you're psychologically finished to quit. You know, and I admire him as one of the greatest actors of all time.
Mm-hmm. Like Jimmy Cagney.
Yeah. James
wow.
Yeah.
Watch some of his films.
Yeah.
He is a talent that dwarfs the talent of today.
Mm-hmm. You talk about
the fucking guy could do everything.
Yes, yes, yes.
Guy could dance. He was a song and dance man, and he was also an actor, and he spoke Yiddish.
Yeah.
He grew up on the Lower East Side of New York, and, wow. and there was a big Jewish population. Here's an Irishman, he could speak Yiddish.
I won't do the you dirty rat. James, you talked about your family a minute ago and protecting them and all that, and I wanted to ask you about your role playing Harry Morgan on Dexter, because you're the father of Dexter and Deborah on the series.
Yes.
And I'm curious about where you pull from with that role, because your character has a reoccurring kind of a play it again, Sam Bogart kind of a thing going on, where he appears and he gives advice to his son Dexter. But when you're playing Harry, are you thinking father with this bloody, violent side, or are you playing it completely straight and thinking concerned father who's made mistakes in the past, and you're just trying to give thoughtful advice to what is now your only son?
Well, more the latter. I mean, getting involved with bloody violent stuff, it's you know, most human beings can't really do that.
Mm-hmm.
But Dexter is, see, Harry and Dexter, you know, Dexter's a serial killer and he kills bad people, and his father taught him how to do it, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you give it, whenever I do these interviews or something like that, and I say, well, if you think about it, you know, don't fathers send their sons off to do battle and kill the bad guy, like, all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we do? You know, those are the bad people, and we're going to train you to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there's an allegorical aspect to the creation of the characters, I believe, by Jeffrey Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that Dexter's just anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a blank slate, and you know, doesn't have a lot of feeling, but, you know, kind of this blood and gut stuff gets him off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because of the terrible trauma that he experienced,
mm-hmm.
he's writing about somebody traumatized. It's a very, you know, it's a very intellectual kind of thing that Jeff did. And Dexter is actually, the name comes from the Latin, like destra and dexterity, which means the right to be right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and okay. You know, a person's got to be right before they figure they can kill somebody.
Yeah.
You know, villains don't think that I'm bad and evil. They think I'm right.
That's right. Very
right.
True.
You know, this person needs killing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where you have to play these things. I always played those characters like Gans. You know, the fucking guy thought he was right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like I'm evil or violent. It's just like, you know, fuck yeah, I'm evil and violent because these people are fucking wrong and I'm right.
right. That's interesting. Okay.
Look what they did.
Okay.
Just from the Harry-Dexter thing, Harry loves Dexter, and I believe Harry was very traumatized, and he's doing his best to give his son the best advice. And, you know, he's also sending out his little arm of God type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The little hand of God, you know, punish these people. So when I talk with Dex, it's you know, he's pissed off at me sometimes, and it's like, you know, I'm pissed off at him. And but the Harry's love of Dexter is absolutely unconditional.
Mm-hmm.
It's unconditional, and it's very, very deep. And that's where I don't like to reveal this stuff necessarily, but I'm certainly playing it from that, which is an understandable human emotion, you know, as opposed to some kind of result.
Mm-hmm.
Violence and blood is a result. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. We have an announcer on the show, James, and she's a big Dexter fan. Her name's Kay McFarland, and she wanted to ask. And I don't know, I'm sure you're sworn to secrecy and, you know, you can't reveal so much, but...
Odds are I don't even know yet.
Or maybe you don't even know yet, but it was revealed on the show that Harry's character did not die of a heart attack, I think it was, but it was that he actually committed suicide. And part of that was driven by him seeing what Dexter had become. And she's saying, well, he kind of groomed Dexter to kind of become that. Do you really think his character committed suicide?
Personally, if I were the writer,
yeah,
would I think that? Definitely not.
Okay.
If I were in the writing room telling him where the shots would go, I would, no.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Gotcha. And we'll leave it there on the floor.
You know, I mean, I don't know if I, you know, I don't know, if, you know, for me, for just from a creative standpoint, what I think would be kind of cool to see happen, and nobody has intimated this to me. Mm-hmm. So this is just my brightest wish, and I don't think it's going to happen. But Harry's still alive.
Okay.
You know, Harry's still alive somewhere.
Okay. Okay.
Because, you know, he's got to be pretty crazy, too.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. You told us a little bit about Red. Is there anything more that you can tell us about the film and what we can kind of expect? I mean, obviously, you said you had a smaller part in the movie.
Well, I think it's I think it's going to be really cool. I Red is retired, extremely dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that means, and I think Willis is really, really good, and he carries these kind of espionage action flicks very well, and Malkovich is just the bomb. The guy is really cool.
Yes, he is.
Mary Louise Parker is a flawless actress, mm-hmm. and Robert Schwenke is a really great director. So I mean, all the ingredients are there.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a dynamite cast, huge stars, and it's a good story. I enjoyed it.
Mm, okay. Were you a fan at all of because my understanding is you're not a big comic book fan, but that you have an appreciation.
I don't know where you got that idea.
Well, I mean,
I grew up on comic books. I devoured comic books. You know, come on, I played Hawkman. I'm in Justice League.
Okay, all right.
I mean, what the fuck?
So that was with intention, not just because it's a job.
No, I'm not. No. I love those. I took the Hawkman thing. I loved that.
Okay. Cool. Okay.
That was a great role. You know, comic books for me have always been a great release because they're mythic and wonderful. And I loved Conan, the comic book Conan. I was very bummed out that Arnold Schwarzenegger played Conan.
Mm.
Well, because, you know, I don't feel that you should use a cartoon to play a comic book.
Oh.
You know, for me, he was just a beef head. You know, just a big muscle head. You know, what a lame choice.
Yeah.
What are you saying, James?
Huh?
That was a very bad, very bad Arnold impersonation. I apologize.
Go and get out of here. Get down! Those are innocent women and children down there.
Exactly.
Oh.
Yes, I'm from Detroit. He was fucking great in Terminator.
Yeah, he was awesome. Yeah, he was awesome.
You know, absolutely great. And I think in Total Recall he was pretty good too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Conan, it just, you know, for me, Conan was Conan just was not that sculpted, kind of blown up. No, Conan. I took that one hard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I was expecting more of a realistic kind of adventure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. Not the cartoon. We heard something about you having at some point you had a desire to see Magnus Robot Fighter.
Yeah, man. Come to wouldn't life. That be cool?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, was that Gold Key or Dale?
Sure, that was Gold Key.
That was Gold Key.
Gold Key, yeah.
Yeah, Magnus the Robot Fighter in Northam.
Oh, man, there you go. Yes.
Look at James Remar.
Yeah.
Get your geek on, James.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, are you kidding? That's the good stuff. I collected all the early issues of Heavy Metal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I had all the DC stuff. I was a total DC guy, and the early Marvel stuff, mm-hmm. I had all of it.
Okay. Wow. All right.
You know, stupidly, I didn't collect them and keep them in a nice place. I had a stack of comic books, and I was totally into Legion of Superheroes. I think that would be a very interesting, tough thing to make into a movie.
It would
yes.
be.
Yes, yes.
I'm generally very disappointed by all the action superhero flicks.
Okay.
And actually, I think Iron Man was pretty good.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
I think Downey did a good Tony Stark, mm-hmm. and I thought it was quite credible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was one that disappointed you, James?
You know, I've never liked the X-Men.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, Hugh Jackman was pretty good in the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, it just kind of left me cold. And the Fantastic Four was just terrible.
Yeah, that was horrible. Yeah.
We can all agree.
Yeah. All four times, all three times.
You know, I just didn't like it at all.
Mm-hmm. I got you.
I'm probably not allowed to say that, but there I went ahead and did it again.
Well, we'll go ahead and podcast it away. So.
Right. not a problem. Not a problem.
I mean, you know, but being a geek, you're allowed to say these things, right?
That's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We do it all the time, but we understand, you know.
No, but I mean, that's like all those actors are going to be mad at me now.
Nah. We can say we cajoled it out of you.
Right, right.
You know, so.
Yeah, I mean, let me see. What are the other ones? You know, I think the Hulk was, I didn't see the second one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I thought the first one had its merits. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a tough thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the second one, if you see the second one, I think you'll be surprised. I think
I heard it was might even be better.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. definitely, by a long shot.
Mm-hmm. See, I didn't like any of the Hulk movies, so.
Even though I think Nick Nolte was excellent in the first one. But I think he just didn't have a good script for him, I don't think. It was kind of a little heavy-handed about we wanted to turn it into a monster by the end of the flick, that's all we knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It was heavy-handed. It got but you know, I think Ang Lee is such a great director that, you know, some of the stuff when he had the Hulk jumping around was really beautiful.
Oh, yeah, the desert scene was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The desert scene was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I loved that desert scene. I loved it when he was fighting those dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Now, James, what did you think about the Dark Knight and the very first Batman Begins?
The Dark Knight, the one with Christian Bale and mm-hmm. Liam Neeson.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well,
that was outstanding.
Yeah, that was the first one. The second one was actually Dark Knight. The first one was Batman Begins.
Batman Begins was outstanding.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Heath Ledger in Dark Knight was absolutely one of the best performances I've ever seen.
Yes,
ooh, I agree.
He got the Joker.
Yeah.
Yes.
He perfect. Finally made sense of that character.
Yes.
Yep.
You know, Cesar Romero and Jack Nicholson didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was still a comic book, you know, but when Heath Ledger did it, that was a living, breathing person.
Right.
And it was a fucking great villain. It was one of the best I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
He was more relatable from a humanistic perspective. I mean, enough respect to Cesar Romero as far as the comedic side of the 70s,
the 60s, yeah.
60s Batman, because that was more of a...
It was a reflection of the comic at the time.
I think. It was lighthearted. It was relaxed. Yeah. But as far as playing a realistic, believable character, I believed, like you said, Heath Ledger's performance as Joker. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. He transformed.
You know.
Wow. Yeah. Well, the thing is, the Joker wasn't really. They weren't really, you know, characters. They're just like these kind of goofy, you know, goofy things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yet, you know, when Heath Ledger took a hold of that, what you had was you had somebody that had scars on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And he wore makeup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wore this makeup, and he wore the makeup in such a way that it was just off enough. But, you know, he talked about somebody that had been brutalized. You know why I got these scars? Because my dad did this. And, you know, he told the story. It was a different story every time.
Every time, yeah.
But I'll bet you all of them were true. Mm. And that thing that he was doing with his tongue when he was flicking his tongue in and out.
Yeah.
There's... When somebody's been on medications that are, you know, very, very strong medications that are antipsychotic medications,
mm-hmm.
they develop these things called extrapyramidal effects, you know, that are permanent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can, you know, develop these twitches and this kind of thing. And I just had this, without them even saying it, that here was a guy that had been in the nut house, in the mental wards, that had been brutalized and slashed and beaten and just developed this... Yeah, and yet was a genius,
yep.
and just so didn't give a fuck, but just had to be, like, you know, seen and heard, but he had no, his logic was illogical.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to work out something that just couldn't be worked out, Jesus, he blew it. He just blew the fucking doors off it.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And you know, when you're playing parts that, you know, like that mental illness, it's so it's very stressful.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I I'm not surprised that the guy had to take medications to relax and
right.
to sleep and whatever it was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because when you play those kind of parts, when I played Dutch Schultz, you know, I only felt normal when I was playing Dutch Schultz.
Mm.
When I took my makeup off and went home, I didn't feel right.
Mm.
You know, because I had my hair kind of shaved back and it looked weird. I did not feel like myself.
Yeah. This was in Cotton Club, James?
Yes, and
okay.
I had a fake nose, and I had these plumbers in my mouth. I spent so much time being Dutch Schultz, you know, 12, 14 hours a day, you know, looking very different, you know, at the age of 28, for many, 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 many days, weeks and weeks and weeks on end, that was when I felt normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it started, and it fucked with my head.
Mm.
It was, you know, and that's things started to take off for me in the old little druggy world. Not long after that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always had a propensity for it, but, you know, I don't know Heath Ledger personally. I didn't know his demons. I didn't know anything really about him. But I see that part, and I see what, you know, I mean, he brought a comic book to authentic life. And, man, I just admire the hell out of that performance. I really, really do. And, hats off.
My wife, Samantha, absolutely adores you as Richard from Sex and the City, James.
Well, she's a smart lady.
I definitely know so. But she doesn't know you from, like, your other populist roles, you know, such as we've discussed earlier in the show. Is it satisfying to get love from so many different fan bases, due in part to being so prolific and, you know, choosing, you know, these various roles, you know, from people that know you from just exclusively from one place, but don't know you any of your other roles?
Well, you know, yes, it is. In a word, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I really love, you know, Sex and the City because it, you know, introduced me to the female audience
mm-hmm.
in a way that they hadn't really seen me before. And you know, the guy stuff that I've done has been mostly, you know, guy flicks.
Right.
And
right.
and the only real chick flick I've done has been Boys on the Side.
Oh yeah.
And women know me from that, and they know me from Sex and the City, which really won me an audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Dexter is you know, goes through a lot of various strata of the population.
Mm-hmm.
But to win over any I guess demographic or group is really, yeah, it's very rewarding. And you know, yeah, it really is.
One last question for you, James. Back in 1981, you did a film called Wind Walker.
I did.
And inside of that, you were given the honorary name of Standing 20 by the Cheyenne.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean?
It fills my heart in such a way that I'm so grateful that I got to be a part of that before it was, they gave me permission to play that part because I had done the Long Riders and they had a search out for somebody to play, you know, the young Windwalker, the young Cheyenne Brave.
Mm-hmm.
And they auditioned a lot of people and of Native American heritage even, and they couldn't find him. They said, hey, let's get that Native American guy from Long Riders.
Mm.
And I showed up, and I had blonde hair because I was playing a Nazi on Broadway. And they kind of freaked out, and they sprayed my hair black and put me in a wig, and I got to audition. I did a screen test for it.
Mm.
And they signed off on it, and I got to speak the Native American languages, and I asked the guy by the name of Harold Goss Coyote, who was the technical advisor and the language supervisor on the film, and he was he's passed on now, but he was he had been a Green Beret in Vietnam in 1963. He had cross tomahawks tattooed on his forearm, you know, and it said Indian Green Beret, and the guy was just amazing. And I went over to his chair and I kind of kneeled by it, and I just said, "Do you think it would be okay if I played this part?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, I asked his permission because I know, you know, come on. And I said, and he looked down at me, and he just said, "I think you'll do just fine."
Mm. Yeah, that's
and cool. they kind of adopted me, and I was very, you know, it's just the Native American just has had the roughest life. Mm-hmm. You know, it just has had the roughest life. I mean, they don't all get casino money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's all kind of new. Mm-hmm. You know, and I knew them before they got in. I visited the Cheyenne Arapaho Reservation, man, and, you know, those people have nothing. It's a real living tragedy, mm-hmm. and they've been very, very helpful to us. Mm-hmm. Anybody else that has come after, mm-hmm. that's what I mean by us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a film that I really got to transform in, and you get to see me as a young leading man, and I recommend it. It's a movie that we shot it for like almost nothing. And, you know, it was an Academy Award-winning director, a guy by the name of Keith Merrill, who did The Great American Cowboy, won the best documentary in 1974.
Okay.
And it's actually an allegorical film for the Mormon faith.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. And you know, he was Mormon, and we shot it in Utah, and I didn't really know this going in. But, you know, I'm riding horses bareback, and it's a hell of an experience. Mm-hmm. And to me, it is really one of my most satisfying roles, mm-hmm. Without question. I mean, it's, you know, I can do this, you know, and I shaved my sideburns off so my cheekbones looked higher, and you know, rode the horse. I got thrown 3 times the first day.
Wow.
You know, you know, I was so filthy in this one scene where I bring all these horses back and win the hand of the girl that I love, and you know what you'd think is typical Disney fashion, but it's just a much more textured version of that. But that scene where I bring all those horses, I am so covered in filth because I have been rolling around in this dirt, been thrown by these horses. It's real dirt.
Okay.
And you know, that was it's one of my personal favorites. It's a long time ago, but I loved that part and really believed in it.
Now, James, did you tell us what standing 20 means?
It means like in 20 hands high. Mm. Like you measure a horse in hands.
Oh,
and
yeah.
A tall horse is 17 hands. So standing 20 is that's a tall man.
Okay.
And I'm not, but you know, they were saying this, that you have stature.
Okay.
And it was a name that had been passed on because names don't get created, and it was the name of one of Harold Goss Coyote's uncles.
Hmm. Okay.
And it's pronounced in the Cheyenne language Nisoayuif. Okay. And its translation is you're standing 20 hands high.
Hmm.
Wow.
That's cool.
And that you are, sir.
Yeah, yeah. You are standing.
Well, I'm sitting down right now on my weight bench.
Well, that concludes another edition of Sidebar. I'm your announcer, Kay McFarland. Sidebar is a podcast on the subjects of comic books, art, and popular culture, created and co-hosted by Dwight Clark and Swain Hunt. Any questions, comments, or suggestions for the show, give us a shout at SidebarNation@gmail.com. That's SidebarNation@gmail.com. And you can also subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, Podcast Pickle, Digital Podcasts, and all the other podcatcher sites.